welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, October 7th, 2013, and you are listening to episode 71. My name is Rob, and I'm hanging out with Jason like I always do.
Hey, hey, hey.
Except when he's not here with me, then I'm hanging out with my wife, or if she's not here, I'm hanging out with the cats. You know,
if you're recording a podcast with your wife, I'm going to be ticked. Because yeah. I'm on your podcast.
Yeah.
I'm your podcast homie.
Shut up already. We've got guests. We have some exciting guests with us. We have Randy and Paul from Split Second Games. Hi, guys.
Hey there. Thanks.
Jinx.
Choreographed within an inch of its life.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us, guys. We really appreciate it.
You bet.
Tell us about Split Second.
You start, Ms. President.
Ms. President, sure. Split Second Games is a venture that Randy and I began in about 2 years ago. We've had a game design that we wanted to present to our nephew, and we wanted to, after we saw the playtest audiences who were taking to it and saying, I'd like to buy this prototype from you, we said, let's take a shot at this, and let's make the kind of games that we enjoy making and we enjoy playing. Since that time, Quicksilver has come out in the market a couple of months ago. It's getting some really good critical acclaim, and we're looking to see it get even wider reach as the months go on. Hopefully, it'll be in stores in time for the Christmas holidays.
That's awesome. And I backed on a Kickstarter. I didn't know anything about it other than I looked at your Kickstarter, your page, your video, and what you were presenting, and I was like, man, this game is right up my alley. I love racing games.
Awesome.
And I was just like, I need this. And I love it. We've talked about it on the show before, and I'm a
several
huge
times.
Fan. Yeah. I'm a big fan. So I well done, gentlemen. Well done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a labor of love.
Yeah. Tell us more about how Quicksilver works for any of our listeners out there who aren't familiar with it.
Well, Quicksilver is an airship racing game set in a not quite steampunky but still sort of neo-Victorian England. You're racing airships across the skies of a fictional country which may or may not be England. You are constantly asked to weigh how much risk you're wanting to take on. As the faster you move, you are committed to moving more spaces, and it puts you at risk of losing control of your ship. You have a hand of cards that let you manage some of that risk. You can use these cards to mitigate the luck of the dice, or you can use them to give you a bonus for getting around the obstacles on the board, attacking your opponents, or sacrificing them so that you can move even faster. It ties in a lot of the things that I've loved about racing games over the many years that I've been playing them, and condenses them all into a race that pretty much becomes whatever kind of race your friends want to play. If you want a nice peaceful race, you can be focused on sprinting, and if your friends like pulling out the knives, there's plenty of opportunities to throw elbows and be dastardly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. I think one of the things that's really cool about it is we talk a lot about how much I love Formula D and how much Jason hates Formula D.
True story.
And what Jason hates about Formula D is just the analysis paralysis of it, and that it takes so long to get through the game that, you know, he feels like I'm playing a racing game that should be fast-paced and exciting, but, you know, it just takes an hour to get one lap around the track because everybody's being so careful and so analytical. And yeah. you guys wipe that out. I mean, it's not that you can't be strategic about it, but you drill it down to just such more focused decisions that the whole pace of the game is much, much faster.
Well, you prove that you can be strategic. You can have a game that's about racing that's strategic that still feels like you're racing.
Yeah.
You know?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that was definitely a lot of the conversation in the early days. If we're going to make a racing game, what does it need to be? Yeah. And games like Formula D came up a lot. And Mississippi Queen, and yeah, a lot of different racing games came into the conversation of what is it lacking, what doesn't it do?
Mm-hmm. Formula D, the answer was fun, by the way.
Oh,
that was. I didn't want to say it. But,
I understand that lots of people like Formula D. It's one of the only games that I will openly say that I just don't like.
I have my issues with it, but I don't need to beat up on them because they've got a huge fan base and they're very popular.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, they made a game that people bought for sure.
Yeah.
Actually, I just played a fantastic racing game, and it was so far under my radar. I just played it last Wednesday, by Mayfair back in the 90s, something called Detroit Cleveland Grand Prix. Mm. Oh. And it was I want to say it was a Wolfgang Kramer game, and it was so good.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much about the race. I mean, the races were important, but it was focused on the auctioning off of cars. So if you thought your car had a chance of getting out in front of everybody and winning first place, you ended up with $200,000. How much am I going to end up paying in the auction for this car in the hopes that I'm going to end up getting in front during this race? It played fast, and it had a lot of great decisions with it. I enjoyed it a lot.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, and that was another thing that was going on with us in this game was we don't need another retread of Formula D.
Right.
I really do love Formula D for what it is, but we don't need to make a second one of them. What can we add? What was missing? And when I saw that in Formula D, the big thing I saw missing was there's really not a way to interact.
Right.
You're racing your solo race. If you're lucky, you can draft with somebody, but I want, when I'm playing a game with somebody, I really want to be interacting with the player more than I want to be interacting with the board.
Yeah.
So how can we incorporate that without being so overly just overly AP focused? How am I going to be using this? Right. I want to make tough decisions, but I want to be able to make them, and I want to be able to do that and look at the person across the table from me when it's happening.
Said, and it was in those early days of playtesting that really helped us dial it in when we started seeing experiences of people going, okay, I'm going to attack your ship, to people looking at the other player and going, okay, I'm shooting you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a major, major moment where we knew that, okay, we've dialed in on the correct wording, on the right feel of the thing now. We want people to be playing against people, not little pieces on a board.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a really cool thing to point out.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's great. Well, since we already hit up on this topic, what have you guys been playing lately?
I played Detroit. I played Detroit Cleveland Grand Prix, and again, knocked my socks off. I played the Battlestar Galactica expansion, the Daybreak expansion.
Okay.
We'll talk about this more about roles and stuff. But oh my gosh, that expansion is insane. The things it adds to the base game and how it just draws out this experience and makes each decision much more painful as a result. You're familiar with the game, right?
We haven't played it. No, we've heard nothing but rave reviews.
That's the one with the traitor mechanic. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
One person's like a Cylon in secret.
Yeah. In a six-person game, two people will be Cylons at some point. They won't necessarily be out the gate. It could happen at the midway point in the trip. They were human all this time, but no, they were actually Cylons, and something tripped and they were triggered as agents. And now you're fighting for the other team. They take it and just amp it up with this version by adding a mutineer in the middle of the mix. They make it run even longer. You have to go even farther to get to Earth, but they add this mutiny thing where every turn you run the risk of having to draw these mutiny cards that do something positive and do something negative. So it's always throwing suspicion on you. And if you have more than one in your card at any time, they throw you in the jail cell. Mm. So you're constantly trying to keep from getting put in a prison space, which is kind of a negative play experience. And at the same time, if you do that, you're doing something that is actively sabotaging them more often than not, even if it does give you something awesome. So the tension between I'm a good guy, no, I'm a bad guy, no, I'm a good guy, really, I had to get this out of my hand, just goes through the roof, and it adds like another hour's worth of play onto it. So if this is something you really enjoy, I can't recommend it enough. It's insane.
I'm going to point out here, Paulie, that you've just done a much better job selling the new BSG expansion than you did Quicksilver.
I think the BSG needs the help is the problem.
Yeah.
Like Quicksilver sells itself. Right. People go, oh, it's a licensed property. It can't be any good. No, you should really check it out.
Well, that was good. Masquerade was a game that I recently played that stuck out in my memory a lot.
What is that?
Masquerade. It's a new game from
Bruno Fedutti.
Bruno Fedutti. Who published that?
I believe it was Asmodee.
Yeah, yes. I think we chased him down at their booth at Gen Con to get a copy of that. But it's a how do you describe that? if we use shorthand, people who play Love Letter wouldn't have a difficult time acquainting themselves with Masquerade. But basically, everyone gets to assign themselves a role, a person. And I think this may come up a bit later in our conversation, but are you guys still with us?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
computer went dark.
My screen turned off, so I just wanted to make sure you guys are still there. Okay. But it is a bluffing strategy, lying, but also memory game, I suppose.
Yeah. It plays well to people who can count cards, sort of. Everybody has an identity, and that identity gives you a certain power. So if you were the king, for instance, if you had the king card in front of you, the king card would get you 3 coins. First person to 13 coins wins. So on your turn, you can either look at the card that's in front of you so that you know what it is that you are. You can exchange a card with somebody else at the table, underneath the table, maybe giving them their original card back, maybe giving them your card. Or you can just put your hand on the table and say, look, I'm the king. And if nobody else around the table says that they are the king, then you can just take the money without revealing your role. But if somebody goes, no, I'm the king. And you could have three people and it's just, no, I'm Spartacus. And everybody flips over their card. Everybody who claims to be the king at that point flips over their card. And whoever is the king, if there is a someone, they get to do the benefits of the king. And everybody else has to give up a coin from their hand into the courthouse.
Yeah.
Now, there's a judge card that says, I'm the judge. I get all the coins from the courthouse. So the game plays fast as a result. There's never a lack of money. Money keeps getting added into the system, and it never leaves. So it's almost like a less cutthroat version of the Resistance. For large groups of people where you have like 6, 8, 10, 12 players, you can have this huge game and have all of this lying and bluffing going on without ever feeling like somebody is attacking you for it.
Yeah.
And so it makes a great party game that way.
And the artwork was just stunning.
It's insane.
Stunning. Yeah. And there's not a lot of components to it. It's a handful of cards and then some money and a bank to put it in. But yeah, the production quality on it was off the charts, and it's the kind of stuff that whenever I see a game like that, lets me know we have to ramp up our game to meet up to that on the next one.
True story.
And it scales well from just a few people up to 12?
We played it with 4 with our first play, and I haven't played it with a group up to 12 yet, but it seems like the scaling would go... It would obviously become a lot harder to count the cards as you go along, as you add more people to it, but... Yeah, there's no reason why it wouldn't work with a large crowd.
So it almost sounds to me like Citadels, except for are you guys familiar with Citadels?
Very much.
So I can be like, well, I'm the assassin, so I'm going to kill you, even though I'm not the assassin. And if no one says, no, you're not the assassin, then I just killed someone, right? That's awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. Except it doesn't have that whole, I'm going to take this whole handful of cards and everybody's going to pick one as that goes around the circle and I'm stuck with these two options that I don't want. No, you have one card in front of you, slap down, bang, on the table. And from there, everybody first reveals who they are the first few rounds, and everyone has to change cards and or not change cards, who knows, just to put some suspicion in the air. And then there you go.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah.
On the RPG side of things, I've been playing Durance a lot lately.
Oh, Durance is awesome.
I don't know it.
Durance is by the same guy who wrote Fiasco, which has a lot more notoriety.
Absolutely.
Tabletop to its credit. It is similar in that situation of it's just open-ended role-playing, but it is set in a... prison colony on some planet, and what the makeup of the colony, the planet you're on, the conditions and all that are set out at the beginning of the game. But there's a list of, I believe, 10 roles of either the people who are working for the prison or prisoners, that they all have different roles there. And it's all games of trying to get the best possible scenario for you, but it always ends up going for me.
Yeah, there's this it's an amazing game of power structure and power plays. The game ends when either half of the 10 characters have died or have broken their personal oaths to the colony.
Yeah.
So half of the game is setting the player up who said, you know, I will never betray my brother. Half of the game is, I want to see the scene where you have to like decide whether or not you're eating or you're betraying your brother. Nice. Let's see how that goes.
Yeah.
Cool. Very
cool. It's not wacky like Fiasco. It's pretty serious and heavy. So
it's grim.
Yeah, it's dark. It's dark.
Is it grimdark?
It's grimdark.
Grimdark.
Wow.
Wow,
that sounds like a comic from the 90s.
Yeah.
He was my favorite goth rocker.
Yeah. Cool. Right on, yeah. How about you, Jason?
You always ask me that. Like, yeah. I've been playing stuff.
Yeah.
What have I been playing recently? You know, the most recent thing I played, honestly, was just we played some prototypes.
Yeah.
You know, we played a lot of your game, Maelstrom. That's what Rob's been playing.
Yep.
And then I played a lot of Sandbox Shodown actually at Grand Con, more than I expected to. Mm-hmm. And then, I played some of the Transylvania Trading Company, my newest proto. So that's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's basically like a game where you bid and there's auctions, but you're in this caravan and you're driving around, wagoning around Transylvania, going to these different places, and you're trying to just buy goods and then sell goods. But the problem is, when you're buying these lots of things, people keep giving you werewolves, and then you're like, well, I can't have. You're like, now I got this werewolf in my wagon, and this is a problem. So then you go to a city, and you're like, hey, you want to buy some food? And they're like, yeah. And you're like, here's some food, and here's a werewolf, and then. So they pay you for the food, and then you give them a werewolf, and then the whole city shuts down because, you know, everyone's getting eaten by a werewolf.
But I didn't order a werewolf. This is a terrible caravan.
So that's the game. It's got this auction mechanic where you're each player gets dealt a card, and then a card is put in the center of the board. Everybody gets to look at their card and then put their card on top. So if there's four players, there's five cards in the auction, and you bid based on what you saw and how the other players are bidding, so you can bluff people. Like, I see a werewolf, I'm going to bid high, so people think I saw something good, but then you just bought a werewolf. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's working pretty well. So Rob didn't get to play it, unfortunately, but hopefully we'll get to play it together soon. So
I like that.
How was Grand Con? It broke our hearts that we couldn't make it out there.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was their first year, and I would say for a first-year con, it was a spectacular hit.
Yeah.
Cool.
More people than they expected.
Yeah.
In a good way. They still had space. Though I think next year they're going to get some extra space.
Bigger venue, yeah.
Which they'll need. But we were impressed by the publishers that came. I mean, notable exceptions. Split Second Games wasn't there.
Yeah.
But,
understood.
But the guys from Sentinels were there, from Greater Than Games. That was pretty cool.
Fantastic.
They drove a lot farther than you guys would have had to.
Just laid on thick.
We're just running out.
I just realized you guys are in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
No? Yeah, so...
Just a little north of Chicago.
Man, you totally could have came. Next year, you guys should really go, because you'd like it.
Yeah.
It was cool, because it was a smaller con, but, I mean, they said they were still selling games. But what was cool with it being a smaller con was you got so much more time to talk to some of the designers that were there and other publishers and stuff. So it was actually probably a better networking event than Gen Con was, because Gen Con, everybody's so busy, you know?
Yes. It was for us, at least, yeah.
We got to do some real great networking and hang out with some designer friends we have and some publishers and stuff, so.
Yeah, we had a great time.
And Rob got to play Maelstrom like 100 times there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Will you be bringing it up to Milwaukee for Protospiel?
Oh, we're trying to decide. We don't know if we're going to make it.
You're going to make it.
When is Protospiel?
This Saturday.
Yeah, okay. We're not going to make it.
Didn't realize that.
We might be there next year, though.
Yeah.
So you guys should come to the one in Ann Arbor next year. That's not that far for you. And that's really close for us. So we missed that one this year because we both had stuff going on that was unavoidable.
Yeah.
But next year, we're planning to be there for sure because it's so close to us. And Protospiel is one of the best things for designers to go to.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
cool.
And Ann Arbor is amazing. It's just an amazing city.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's move on to our feature of the week. And it sounds like you guys are ready to talk about something. What do you got?
Well, and it sort of spawns off of our playing Masquerade and BSG and all these other things. But the purpose of role selection and roles as a mechanic and as a thematic element in games, I think is something I'm noticing a lot more of as we design our games and as we see games that are really sort of making a mark in the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I've been seeing more and more of that too. Why do you think that is?
I think it's there's still a lot of room for exploring how to get those into games. Like you had mentioned Citadels, and that was a great example of the use of roles inside a game. But I think it's the way the industry seems to move is that as soon as there's a hot mechanic, it gets played to death.
Yeah.
And then we move on to find a new one. And I think roles is one that's just kind of been comfortably coasting along. That hasn't been oversaturated yet, so it's a lot of fun to see a game come out and do it really well. I think Battlestar Galactica may be, you know, an incredibly prime example of that. But of the utter tension that just having a single card placed in front of you adds to a game, the paranoia, the mistrust, the finger pointing, just watching your reputation completely tank with the table through a perceived bad decision when you're the only person who knows what the other option was.
And there's like, especially with that game, you can end up with three layers of roles being put on you as a part of the game design itself. I mean, you've got the human versus Cylon aspect. It tells you which team you're on. It gives you a clear indication of what your goals are. And it gives you, if you're a Cylon, it gives you a little indication of something really nasty you can do if you want to take advantage of a bad situation and completely tank the other team.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something awesome you can do. Why wouldn't I want to do that? It's an awesome power. Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
So you've got that one aspect. Then you have this aspect of the roles on the actual ship themselves, with the admiral being able to tell what planet you're going on, and the CAG being able to send out more people, and the president having all of these extra powers of the office. Each of those things on their own is a cool add-on, but you mix that, layer that in with the powers of, like, am I on the right team or am I not on the right team, the suspicion only grows.
And then you have your temporary roles in the game where, okay, you're going to jump out in the fighter to go fight the Cylon Raiders. I'm going to go over to sick bay to heal, or I'm going to go over to or people don't trust me, so I've been sent to the brig. And there's a lot of different the way you plan out each round of, okay, you go do this, you go do this, you go do this. There's all the spaces on the ship that have different functions for the ship itself. So you're doing your quick tactical role selections as well as the things that carry with you throughout the game.
And then finally, everybody's got their own character, which is incredibly, incredibly useful to understand what your role is, and breaks down even like the benefits that your character has and the disadvantages they have and why they're there. I played the game before I even saw the television show, and I gotta say, I knew the characters like the back of my hand by the time I got there, because oh, it's this, he's the drunk. Okay, I understand that. Why do you say that in the game?
Yeah.
You just keep layering all those things on top of each other, and you have this amazing thematic experience. And I think that's what people there are camps of people who really expect and want a deep thematic experience with a game, and they get disappointed when something doesn't let them embody that theme well.
Mm-hmm.
Like City of Remnants, with each of the different factions having its own feel, is an extraordinary another extraordinary example of like how roles, in this case, in the space of factions, completely reflavors the game in a way that you wouldn't necessarily have. We're seeing kind of the cutting edge of that stuff right now going on with the Android Netrunner.
Yeah.
At least for me,
yeah.
I'm seeing just like, they're breaking out each group into their three different factions, and then each of their factions has five different identities that you can run as, and each of them is going to flavor exactly how you build up your deck and all the strategies that you could be doing or you could be bluffing doing. It's just these kinds of things are what just hook into me and get me going as a player. When we started out with Quicksilver, we initially had eight different ships with eight different pilots that you were supposed to embody.
Yeah.
You were going to be the mad Irishman. You were going to be the spunky little 15-year-old pilot from England. You were going to be the dastardly, sneaky, mustachioed villain from the Confederate States of America. You're going to have all of these things. And then we realized that this was one of those rare times when embodying a role got in the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it stopped being about me being in the game anymore, because it was about being this other guy.
Right.
So knowing when the roles are something that's adding to theme and when it's subtracting from theme is also a good thing to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
And that's a good point, because it's easy to just be like, I'm going to put roles in this game to add more diversity, and then it's a bad idea.
Right.
Right.
Now I want to challenge you on something here, because at the start of this conversation, you said that this is an idea, a theme, a feature, a mechanic that hasn't been fully explored yet. So what's new? What route would you take to explore this in a different way?
Funny you mention that. We're working on a game right now that is a spy theme. And as the actions of the game progress, your team starts developing its own specialties and its own roles. And as your team becomes more efficient in doing and taking on missions that involve cunning versus that involve force, your team of spies becomes more underground, or it becomes more brute force. So that as your team grows, your roles and your abilities expand almost RPG-like.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think in general, I think there is more room for the hybridization of board games and role-playing games. There are, you know, there's certainly, as we're mentioning, games where you are adopting a character, a persona of somebody inside the game. But being able to see that carried on further, being able to see, I'm not sure how one would go about it, but I'm the creative director, not the designer. So, I see there being a space there for more crossover for campaigns.
Yeah.
Of a board game that can go on.
There's a great little card game RPG mashup called Bacchanalia,
mm-hmm.
that's all about you trying to escape the city in the middle of the Bacchanal, and it is a card based game that is pulling out a story as it's going along. I think that is something that I'm keeping an eye on in terms of how it manipulates story through the elements of a card game. I want to see how story can be manipulated in the ways of a full board game. Not so much like Talisman or Tales of the Arabian Nights, where you're there to tell a story and here's the story that is happening, but here are some open-ended things that happen as a result of the actions that you're taking, and from that, story grows.
Okay,
that's interesting.
Kind of like Winter's Tales. Winter Tales from FFG is kind of going to start going to start tapping into this a little bit. Got a really close eye on this.
Okay. So what your exploration here is that this idea of taking on a specific role or embodying a role in the game, not necessarily to use their special powers to get the most points, but to go in that RPG direction to try and facilitate more story, more interactivity, I guess.
Right, to make the play about the game itself, not about winning.
Gotcha. Yeah, to immerse the players in the world.
Sure, exactly.
Yeah.
So that then, even if it's a game where there's a clear winner and losers, at the end of the game, it wasn't about, you lost, you don't care, because it was about the journey to get there.
Right.
I would love a game where somebody came out of it going, look, I scored the most points, I won. But everybody at the table kind of goes, yeah, you won the game, but that guy over there won because he like did this amazing thing that nobody else imagined was going to happen.
Yeah.
And everybody's talking about that rather than the victory.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of an exciting proposition there.
It's – we hope. Keep poking at it. It's hard.
Yeah.
Board gamers, and there is a lot of crossover in the worlds. of gaming. We're hoping to find people who do sort of want to have that crossover happen. It's getting easier to bleed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I've said before on the show how I struggle with storytelling games because I like story and I like narrative and I enjoy that in a role playing game, but when it comes to playing a card game, I play games to have fun. I'm not that jerk who plays to win exclusively, but I like knowing that there's a goal. And so with storytelling games, I struggle because I kind of want to work towards that goal, and I have trouble just kind of reveling in the story.
Very much so, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. Especially when I play Fiasco, sometimes I'm like so hell bent on getting the dice that I forget that this doesn't make any sense for me. Like, no, I want to light this guy on fire. Let it happen. That game taught me about the values of failure so much.
Yeah.
between all the playtests of Quicksilver and actually playing Fiasco, I've come to really embrace failure.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Indeed. All right, I'm going to pass the mic for a second and go get a glass of water real quick.
Yeah, uh-oh. Sure. Cool. So, yeah, I mean, Jason, you're a big fan of different roles, different abilities based on the player role selection, and I tend to shy away from that because I kind of fear the complexity that is so inherent with that.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, so I've a lot of my designs have had either role selection. Freaky Tiki had the role selection with the where you're trading tiki masks, and each tiki mask gives you a different role, a different power, or Gunslinging Ramblers. One of my original designs that is mostly based around you being different cowboys, and each cowboy has a power and a role that you fill. So I think there are a couple different ways to take it. You know, there's this Citadel style route or this Masquerade route where it's I've got this role, this turn, and now it's gone, right? Or, you know, there's also the idea like I have with Ramblers where it's this is me, like this is my guy, and I can change, but, you know, I think the thing I like about roles so much, in those both settings of like Forbidden Island is a great example of roles permanent. Like,
yeah,
I've got this role for the entire game, and sometimes it makes the game less fun. If you would just randomly shuffle out the roles, which I almost never do, because if you want to be super strategic with the game and win it, like in hard mode, You need to be strategic about who you get. If you don't have the engineer, you're probably going to lose.
Yeah.
if you get this scuba diver and like nothing else, you're going to lose. You know, you want the engineer, you want the pirate. That's how the game is played. I'm not the pilot, the pilot, not the pirate. That would be different though if you had the pirate.
Oh, if you made that a traitor, if you made that a traitor mechanic, it would be awesome.
Right. It's actually the pirate. He wants to sink everyone on the island because he's trying to hide his treasure.
Because that's mine.
That's awesome.
And certainly because we do not have enough traitor mechanics in board gaming.
Not at all.
Right. So, you know, I think that, I think what's so cool about them, to me, is I love variable player powers. Like, I just love variable player powers. And role selection having roles is the easiest way to do that, right? I think the hardest thing about roles, other than the fact, like you said in Quicksilver, it could have added a level of complexity that was unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
I actually would be interested to play that game, Quicksilver with the roles, just because I love roles so much. But as a designer,
if we sell enough copies of Quicksilver, then you may get your wish.
All right.
This is absolutely true. We've been working on a weather deck for the last couple of months, and it's getting ready to go out soon. And another thing we were talking about is getting just a whole deck of roll cards.
Okay, so
here's your crew
those.
Draft.
I'll buy both those. The hardest thing as a designer, and you're probably dealing with that right now if you're trying to do that, is balancing roles is one of the toughest things you'll ever have to balance in a game. Variable player powers and roles, especially if it's like Forbidden Island, for instance. Like, I get this role for the whole game. Those roles are not balanced. The only reason you get away with it is because it's co-op. The scuba diver, 90% of the time, sucks.
Yeah.
There's a couple instances where he's your man, but the pilot still would be better at it. So, you know, in a co-op game, they can get away with not balancing it, right? But if that was a game where you were playing against each other, every time you got that, you'd be like, well, I'm at a huge deficit now. to, you know, to accomplish the goals I need compared to the other players. And I think with role selection, you just have to be so careful, you know, with the permanent roles. With the non-permanent roles, I say make it broken. Citadels, for instance, you know, I mean, the assassin and the thief are both too powerful if you are good at guessing who has what.
Right.
But you don't keep them all the time. And I know that if I kill you this turn, you might get the assassin next turn, and you're probably going to kill me.
But so, only if they know what role you took.
Right.
Because
right.
the assassin only kills by role. And that's where the fun of the meta comes in.
Right.
And you were talking about broken rules. Like, one of my favorite games, bar none, Cosmic Encounter.
Oh, yeah.
And it, if you just look at the different race powers, it is crazy broken.
Yeah.
If you want to call it broken, there are certain powers that are just astronomically better than others, like factor of five better than others.
Yeah.
But you see somebody get that power and you go, oh, no, that's the guy we got to watch.
Yeah.
Right.
And the meta sort of takes care of itself that way. If in that case, and also like with Bang, like some of the card powers, some of the personalities, crazy powerful. They have less health as a result of it.
Right.
Like there are ways to balance these things out so that it does have a little bit of evenness to it. But without some extra balancing thing, it's rough.
Yeah.
He did a little better job with Forbidden Desert because like the different characters had different amounts of water that was available to them. So if you had a crazy great power, you had less water.
Oh, so like the scuba diver would have literally had like buckets of water.
He's in water, so yeah.
is there still? I hope there's still a scuba diver in the desert because yes, he would be just as effective there as he would be in the original game. So, yeah, I actually tried to buy Forbidden Desert this weekend, but they were sold out. I was really sad.
It's an interesting take.
Yeah. Well, we're running short on time already. We need to move on to practicing the pitch. You gentlemen have a game to pitch to us tonight, right?
Yes. Yes. Actually, we do.
Okay.
And
go.
The game is Clandestine. You are the spy master for an agency of spies, and you are sent to take down this great threat from a company, an international terrorist organization that is not named Spectre because that's in violation of James Bond rights. But at the same time, you are working together to complete these missions so that you can take down this force. There's a Spectre card that's added into the deck. If the Spectre card shows up and there has not been a victor by that point, Spectre wins, players lose.
Okay.
A certain number of when you're completing a mission, missions will have anywhere from 3 to 9 points on them to complete the mission that needs that many agents on the card. You have roll cards that you can use to put down a number of agents onto a card, move agents from one card to another, grab technologies from your R&D department, or you can go on a bit of a hiatus and get all of your rolls back so that you can do more things. As the missions succeed, you score victory points for them. You also score skill points for them. So if you are doing well, if you are doing a project, if you're on a mission that provides cunning points, you'll get points on the cunning track. And if you get up to 4 points in cunning, then you will get a new roll added to your hand that you can use during your turn as another possible set of actions that you as the spymaster can send your team on.
Okay.
Gameplay ends when the player has hit a set number of victory points, or if the Spectre team shows up before being defeated.
Okay. So is everybody has their own separate hand, separate roles that are available to them?
Yes.
Okay. Is everybody on the same team, or I think you said earlier that everybody is working from a different intelligence agency or something?
Yes. Yes. Think of MI6 versus CIA.
Okay. That makes sense.
We're all working together on this, but...
Yeah.
We're going to be the team that's recognized for bringing down Spectre.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay. And so you have your roll cards, and you can get more. Are you going to lose them? Oh yeah, you did say that at some point you could lose a roll, right?
You have an opportunity to burn a roll, leave an agent out in the cold by saying, I'm going to get rid of this card for the rest of the game, and as a result, I'm going to get the higher level power that's associated with it.
Okay.
So it's sacrificing the rolls for a big boon that you might need right now.
Hey, here's a thought. I mean, all I know about the game is what you just told me, but the first thing thematically that popped in my head when you burn an agent and leave them in the field is that you, there should be a mechanic to where that maybe they can come back as part of Spectre and really jack you over because you burn them and you left them out in the cold, and that's what they do. They get, like, mad, and then they become 006, and you, they ruin your life.
Interesting. We had gone the other tack with that. With if you completed the track, you would be able to get one of your agents back. If you'd gone all the way up to Cunning 7 somehow, you'd be able to get an agent back in.
You're like, hey, man, listen, sorry we burned you before. I know you probably could have died, but we, you want to jump back up? We got a job open.
Exactly. That's the matter.
I'm not poking fun at it. I mean, I was just kidding.
Oh, no. But, poke.
That was my first thought, though, was the idea that if you burn an agent, or maybe they're a freelancer now and somebody else could pick them up, you know.
So is Spectre an active force working against you throughout the game, or is it just simply when their card turns up, ah, crap, we lost?
It's a passive force. The different projects, as they are progressing through, if they are not completing, they are moving on, and there is a mission track that if a project hasn't been completed, it moves one step further on the track.
Yeah.
If it falls off the track, well, then you get your folks back, but that mission was a failure.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's constantly pushing you forward to get these missions completed.
We had played it in earlier iterations with Spectre as an active force in it, and we found it all it added was an extra ball of tar you had to work through.
Yeah, it was absolutely unnecessary. We tried to make it a co-op-ish game, and it didn't work that well with it having an active force against the players.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Maybe instead of Spectre, you could call it Hydra. I think that's free. I don't think that's licensed to anyone.
Excellent.
Maybe their symbol could be like a red skull or something.
That would be a good symbol. Yeah. That would be a great symbol.
Right. I'm trying to remember what the bad guys were in Get Smart.
Chaos,
yes.
Yes, I've gone through every bad acronym that we possibly can. And all it's coming up with is something with a fluffy little bunny. And even I think that's no, it's the cat. It's the cat that's the cat from James Bond. So the bunny, perhaps.
Gadget.
Ah, there it is. There it is.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right.
Is it Claw?
Dr. Claw. Yeah. So take me through a round of the game. Let me see how it flows.
There are five different mission cards out on the field, and each of them is requiring a different. Each of them will provide a different level of bonus on a skill track if you were successfully on that mission. You have a hand of skill via roll cards, and again, one of them might be to infiltrate, and that will let you put down one agent on up to three different available missions. Or you'll have another card that says, put two agents on a mission, move one agent to another mission entirely. So that you can diversify you can get people off of a track that you don't think you're going to benefit from. Or you can get onto a track really quickly to close out that project and score it and make sure it goes successfully.
Okay.
Each of those cards has a different initiative on it, though. So if you're doing your time in the R&D lab, it might go sooner. You might do less things than if you were waiting later in the round with a huge like ninja move that like gets you lots of people out there, but is last to go in the round. And if there's no projects that are cleared for it, then you can't do anything with it. So part of the tension is the valuable stuff is at the back of the is at the back of the initiative line.
Okay, that makes sense. And I like the idea of the track moving along that.
Yeah, that's because you would need some kind of a timeline like that so you know how much time left you have to complete the mission before you fail it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And initially we had it so that Spectre would start adding agents onto it, and if it closed up the agency, then it failed, and nobody got anything, and everybody lost an agent from it, and I was just like, man, this is just way too brutal.
Punishing, yeah.
Yeah, I want people to sweat. I want people to keep worrying about the timeline and keep sprinting toward a big victory.
But we don't want people to feel like they're being waterboarded.
Right.
Never a positive game experience.
No.
And we also don't want people to feel like, God bless ghost stories, where it's just impossible to win. Like, I tell you, you can win ghost stories. I've proven it once in 5 years of playing. But we don't want this to be an impossible thing. We want to see the heroes win.
Yeah.
But if the heroes can't get their act together, they kind of deserve to lose.
Gotcha.
And so as soon as a project has, let's say it's a five, it's a difficulty five project, there's five agents on it. Boom. At the end of the round, it's going to score points. Whoever's put the most agents on it is going to score five victory points on the main track and is going to score 1 point in both of the skill tracks that are available to them. Like this one could be a, again, force and cunning. You get 1 point on force and 1 point on cunning. Whoever is in second place on that track is going to score the number of VP equals to the number of agents that the first person had. So if a five-person project, on a five-project, if Jason had three and Rob had two to close out that project, Jason would score 5 points and Rob would score 3 points. Rob, okay, would also get, Rob would also get his choice of one of the two skill tracks, but not both.
Ah,
that's cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I would try that. That sounds cool.
Yeah, the initial idea was to try to sort of get it so that you could, this was our tying into getting an RPG element into the game, in that is you, if you're deciding I'm going to be doing the force track, you're kind of taking a Jack Bauer approach to your spying.
Yeah. Jack Bauer.
You're going full it. There's no time. And just throwing, you'll have the outgunned card and it will just, you'll be able to throw a lot of people into the mission. As opposed to something with more finesse, and more cunning, which will allow you to be a little bit more, under the radar for the different projects. You're going to wait till the end of the round and then you move all the people around to different spaces.
Yeah.
Like all of these little elements I'm trying to get so that you can make your team the team that you want to go on by selecting the missions that are available and that you want to focus on.
So is the CIA more predisposed to a specific track than MI6, or is everybody pretty even at the beginning?
We started out with it where the MI6 and the CIA each had their own different specialties. Everybody started out with one extra on one of two tracks. I took it out for the sake of playtesting, because mm-hmm. I want to make sure that the core is solid.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
Once it gets back, I want to start introducing that into the playtest modes again and see if that adds an actual feel to it, so that this team is more likely to get those skills, and therefore the play that you have from it is going to be more tailored toward a specific style, but you'd still be able to break it to do whatever you want with it.
So the player is kind of like the director of that organization, is that correct?
Exactly.
Cool. I'm just thinking, like, you know, it's funny if you make like MI6 better at being cunning, or the CIA is better at brute force, or something, and, you know, and you pass those out randomly to a players, and the player that wants to be Jack Bauer gets the cunning group, and it's like the new boss is in charge of MI6 now, and he's, you know, he's like, oh, well, guys, we've been sneaking in the past, but we're going to just blow crap up now, because that's what I know how to do. And, you know.
So having maybe each of those having each agency have a natural disposition, and then you draw a roll card on top of that to add another element to it.
Right.
Yeah.
That way, you end up some different combos every time. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That way, yeah. I think that might be kind of fun. And it's cool that you took it out for playtesting, because, you know, that's, Rob and I have talked about that. That's something Rob is very good at saying, well, I want to add this into the game too, but I'm not putting it in right now because I just need to make sure the base game works. And I'm like, I'm putting all the stuff in.
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
I end up being like, gotta get rid of that.
I made that mistake earlier this month with this project. It was like, here are some suggestions. I'm going to throw all of them in the pot. Well, that was kind of dumb. let's go back to the last known state and let's just add one in and see how that acts with it. much better and much easier to track revisions that way to go, okay, this is when things went off into Never Never Land.
Yeah.
For sure. Yep.
How far along into development are you guys on this?
I'd say we're getting out of main beta and starting to get into the more of the finesse stage. We're hoping to have a solid proto by the end of the year.
That's cool.
Like,
that's great.
To the point where we're at 95% happy with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exciting, man. That's really great.
We'd love to have some to show off by Origins.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we already paid for our table.
And we're getting ready to launch our waterboarding board game.
Sweet. Yeah. I mean, does it come with an actual waterboarding set? I hope so.
It comes with water.
Yeah. Oh, great.
It's basically just a gallon of water.
Yeah, and a rag. Shipping costs are going to be extravagant, but the entry price is going
to
be pretty low.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't think you're supposed to ship liquids, are you? Like, from the post office, don't they? Anything fragile, liquid, perishable? I think that's what they say.
I worry about replay.
Yeah.
Wow, this got dark quick.
It sure did. I'm gonna get us back on track here.
thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey guys, well, we're not running out of time. Do you have a name for your spy game yet?
Right now, we're hinting on Clandestine.
Clandestine. Okay.
Cool.
All right. So Clandestine. Excellent. We're running out of time. Where can our listeners find you guys?
SplitSecondGames.com. At SplitSecondGames on Twitter, but second is spelled 2ND. Facebook/Split2NDGames, or on Google at SplitSecondGames.
Awesome, cool. I'm a big fan of Quicksilver. I am looking forward to Clandestine. I would love to give that a try.
Excellent, thank you.
And we would love to have you guys back sometime to talk about publishing if you're open to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, because that's something that you know, our listeners want to hear about. They want to hear more about what it takes to actually publish a game. You guys did it on your own, so maybe next time we can kind of dig into that.
Yeah,
that sounds great, Jet.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, so thanks for hanging out with us, and thank you to our listeners for listening. We really, really appreciate it. If you want to get in touch with us, you can go to our website, which is buildingthegamepodcast.com. You can also send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at podcastbtg. Jason is at J.A. Slingerland, and I am at poorly_designed. You can like us on Facebook. You can give us a 5-star review on iTunes. In fact, you should give us a 5-star review on iTunes, because why wouldn't you, right? I mean, and you can
yeah,
keep
on.
Yeah, right. You can come back every week, where we will continue to do these crazy shows and talk to awesome people like Paul and Randy from Split Second. Thank you guys one more time.
Thank you
guys
so much
for having us on.
All right, and thanks everybody out there. We'll see you next time.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game.
What you don't hear when you listen to the show is I drop F-bombs the whole time.
Yeah.
Rob has to cut them all out. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Just quoting Jay and Silent Bob the whole time.
Right. Pretty much, yeah. I'm like a one-man Tarantino movie over here.
Yeah.
It's good. It's a good time.
So profanity's out, but extreme racism is just fine. Perfect.